Welcome to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Swinaker and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast and leave an awesome five-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some recent news headlines and hopefully provide some insight, analysis, and practical applications that you can take into the office to help protect your organization. We're joined today by our friend Tyler as well.
Hello. Good to be here.
And the views and opinions expressed by all three of us do not reflect those of our employers.
And I tell you what, we're going to talk about staff retention later, but the easiest way to keep me on staff is donuts and chocolate chip cookies every day. Eventually, I'll be big enough I can't leave.
But the first article we're going to talk about comes from Bruce Schneier on his blog. And he's referencing a talk at DEF CON 29 where researchers were using the GPT-3 general language AI to craft spear phishing emails to volunteers. And what they found in 2 out of 3 tests that the AI actually did a better job of picking out or crafting the email than a human red teamer did.
Yeah, that makes sense. have you ever used have you ever used the GP or looked at any of the results from GPT-2 or 3?
No, I saw there was a talk about using GPT-3 to do code, like turning natural language into code. That was pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's a bit concerning. There's this new thing called Codex that you basically tell it, "Hey, I want a video game, and I want the main character to look like a spaceship," and that spaceship, you know, flies around the screen shooting at these things called asteroids, and you press the space button to fire things, and it will write the code for you. You just give it, you know, that English syntax query or statement around what you want, and it makes it for you, and it understands what you're asking for and then writes the code.
It's going to be really depressing if coding is automated before truck driving.
Well, I think there's a lot of issues with it, you know, but you know, at some point the problem is like the regulation, like what's the penalty of being wrong as a truck driver versus, you know, creating code?
Depends what the code runs.
Yeah, well, that's very true. That's a solid point there. But that kind of also
a truck, obviously.
But you know, those types of things where you can write the code, it's like a better programming language. You know, when SQL was created, they said that was going to be like the last querying language because it's so similar to English and it's so simple to use. And you know, a lot of these languages, you want to make them as easy to use as possible. We're just telling a computer some set of instructions. And so if you can do that with just your natural language, I think that's a better coding language. And then you can review the code that it writes. I don't know. I think it's pretty cool, but it's obviously has some big issues. There's another tool called GitHub Copilot that you basically add some comments about what you're trying to create, and it'll write it for you. And people have tested it against, you know, just, you know, software engineering interview questions, and it performs pretty well.
That's how I'm going to ace that interview.
There you go.
But, do you have to do this with your headphones on? Yes.
But with GPT-2, well, usually it's a screen share, but with GPT-2, they originally came, OpenAI said, you know, this is too dangerous. We're not going to be able to release this into the wild. And their whole thing with OpenAI was, we're going to open source artificial intelligence. But they said, we can't release it because it could be used for nefarious purposes. Well, GPT-3 then became a licensed product that I believe Microsoft licenses for some nominal amount per number of queries.
It is, but 6 cents per 1,000 queries. They mentioned it.
There you go. But, you know, they said, this sounds too much like a real person writing it. So you could disseminate, you know, an information attack with it by creating news articles, or yeah, you could be a really lazy author and say, oh, I'm only going to write a paragraph and let the AI do the rest of my book.
Well, no, didn't we talk about that? Or maybe that was at lunch one time. We talked about like feeding it authors that you liked and then having it build completely new books out of those, you know, feed it like the complete Tom Clancy library and have it start spitting out Tom Clancy like books.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, we did talk about that. That was actually an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Was it?
Yeah, Data and Geordi were going through a Sherlock Holmes mystery, I forget which one, on the holodeck. And Data knew the answer. He'd read the books. Of course, he's really smart. So he solved it in like 2 seconds, and basically they didn't get to play out the full story. And Geordi's like, man, I'm getting gypped here. So they told the holodeck to come up with a story, a Sherlock Holmes-like story, which would challenge Data. And of course, you know, that caused all sorts of problems with Moriarty getting loose and figuring out how to take over the Enterprise and shit like that. But
magic.
Yeah. But yeah, the concept was already there. And I've heard other people talk about the exact same thing where, you know, individuals will be able to have someone basically build stories just for themselves with this AI. You know, you might not care about a Tom Clancy, Stephen King mashup book. But because you have your own AI to do this, you give it the parameters and it generates that book for you. And then uses deepfakes AI to have Tom Clancy actually read the book to you.
Well, there's also these things. I think these were built on GPT-2, but there's these procedurally generated video games where you know, maybe it's text-based, maybe it's not, but it has its own language models, and you basically create the world procedurally as you take actions, and you can have other people there with you. But it's leveraging that, and it's this hyper-personalized product that's been created because of these language models, just like what you're describing with a book, and you're having the author read it to you.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, well, there's some dark corners of the product there that I just described when you just let the individual person write their own world. But certainly,
I can't imagine what could go wrong there.
Yeah, well, yeah. It could be useful for you know, personalizing education or therapy. I mean, there's a lot of different use cases, you know, to gamify any of these concepts. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. Probably the good might outweigh the bad there.
Well, I mean, it really depends on if it gets loose. I mean, you let it into the dark corners of Matt's mind, but if it doesn't get out of his house, is it still okay?
You know, yeah, maybe. Depends. I don't know. I'm not the legislative expert for that one.
Oh, yeah, we need Congress to decide what's good. That's a wise decision. It always works out well.
So we're talking about GPT-3 for, you know, leveraging open source data, well, to craft spear phishing emails. Well, I can generalize about the world because of how it learns these different parameters for language. And it's doing it without labels, which is a pretty cool concept with self-supervised learning. And it's scanning something like 60% of all internet domains, regardless of some, you know, authoritative score. It's far too much data for any person to sanitize. But it does generalize pretty well. And if you could target it towards a particular person based on their open source information, I'd imagine you could get some pretty good results for spear phishing.
Which is what it does.
Well, I think what would be valuable as well is to feed in actual emails, though, because how someone writes in a blog post or writes, you know, in their LinkedIn profile or their resume or whatever may not be how they speak or they, you know, people correspond in email. I think that's a little bit different kind of language and tone used there.
Potentially, but I don't know that you have to get so precise. Like when we were talking about it before, we were positing, you know, it gets in and then it, you know, pulls the PST file and it scans it and tries to create a language model based on the actor it's trying to represent. But, you know, these models are built around, you know, basically just predict the next word that needs to come out or kind of form a sentence and some topic. And so if it just pulls the last couple of emails and replies to those based on whether or not it sees there a question or sees there's some room to respond, then it really is, it doesn't necessarily matter as much, because it's going to sound a lot better than just some layman coming in who is trying their best to extract something. It can make it sound more like genuine language.
And I suppose, you know, they talk about using the Humanatic AI API as well to use personality and behavioral insights based on documents. So from public sources. So that probably helps kind of offset that as well.
Yeah, you'll have to give me more info into how that works.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly how the Humanatic stuff modifies the model. Like I saw in the presentation where they go back and it adds like that this person is, you know, forward. So high calculativeness, high steadiness. They have high attention to detail and aim to find a perfect solution. They always plan things ahead. I mean, I guess I can see some things where they're looking to write emails to try and create plans maybe.
If you have, you know, different clusters of behavior where, you know, you just described a couple different classifications of an individual user, you've scanned some of the open source information to identify which cluster a person belongs to, you could then have different classes of output. So when the language model is trying to formulate a response, it generalizes about these classes. This person is in these 13 buckets. They're not in this, you know, these other 45 buckets, or maybe there's a 65% confidence that they're in this one bucket versus others. And you could use those parameters to generate a response that really does a pretty good job of generalizing to that person's type of language.
Yeah. So if you have the right buckets, because that AI, the Humanatic AI, seemed like it was around, you know, resume and talent acquisition versus actual personality traits. So maybe if that were tweaked more along the lines of, you know, this person really likes sports, or this person has certain affinities or whatever, and you start putting them in those buckets, that might be more advantageous for actually an adversarial AI versus one that this thing seems to be based around, which is kind of resume and talent acquisition, HR type stuff.
You think they're just going to send an email that says, blah, 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 click on this link, go Bears?
I mean, it works on some people.
It could be the theme of the email, though.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because that's one thing they don't really talk about in the article or the slide presentation that I saw, is like the theme of the email, you know, what interests people.
Mm-hmm.
Because the emails that they gave examples for were pretty generic about, hey, you know, we think you'd be a good fit for this job kind of thing. That's about the extent of it, versus being able to pull in their LinkedIn profile and look at their Facebook profile and see that they're very into Duke University. They went to school there during this time frame, you know, so maybe you could take that data, feed that into the model and say, oh, well, I'm going to generate an AI, or I'm going to generate an email that's going to be thematic for the Duke University, targeting someone who went to the university at this time frame where this event happened that they would be interested in hearing more about or reminisce about or whatever.
Yeah, creating these topical models for connections between other people, I think that would be incredibly useful. I don't know that, in spear phishing at an organization, I wonder the model that you're talking about, was it just trying to garner a specific person to replicate them and impersonate them well? Or was this looking at individual person and, edges between these nodes with the other people? So say we go in and we look at 15 different communication paths that are possible, finding one that has the most possible connection points to have this conversation with over email. And say, okay, well, now we've found these 15 people that could get us to where we want, that this person has priors that say they communicate with this individual. Now we pull in their open source information to see where we can, you know, strike up a conversation based on.
Yeah, that wasn't in the article or in the research or whatever that they did. That's just something that I was thinking about would make this more successful. And I think what you're talking about, looking at prior email conversations as well, saying, well, they've communicated with this person in the past, and then kind of going down that rabbit hole and varying the email communication based on that. I think there are a lot of different options here that could make this way more effective than the very small bit that they even did in this research, because I don't think they went down all the rabbit holes they could have to make this even more effective.
Yeah, it was just one study. And it only had 200 people involved. So there's feels like there's a lot more they could do here.
Absolutely. Well,
those were also volunteers. They weren't actual like company employees, which would be different.
One of the other concepts with, you know, GPT-3 I mentioned earlier is that it's scanning all of this open source information, you know, from, I think it's like 60% of all the, you know, available domains, and they just scanned everything. And then they also fed it all of Wikipedia, you know, it has Reddit in there. And there's this
4chan.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's this problem where there's definitely some PII and PHI in there. I mean, there's no way you can sanitize it against all of that. Yeah. And so you could actually query this model. It definitely does not have all the guardrails necessary to protect that. And so you could definitely query that type of model to grab those pieces of information out. Similarly to how it says, you know, this guy went to this particular college, or you could posture about, you know, how to impersonate them. Well, you could also ask queries about them that are incredibly revealing because of the language model. If they've talked online in various different forms, it can aggregate all that content across different places. And maybe it's not so specific as you ask the GPT model, what is this person's SSN or credit card number, but you could probably get some really important PII or PHI from it if you're targeting an individual. And that's like a method of data exfiltration from the language model itself.
Or just blackmail data.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you could find out if this guy's cheating on his wife and et cetera.
Yeah, I imagine that some of the more common dating sites or forums where you would be able to pick up that information was scanned. I mean, this is a lot of the internet that they're scanning. It's 175 billion parameters, I think.
Wow.
Yeah.
What's interesting about that is that's one of the things that they always talk about to young kids these days, like everything you put online stays there forever, but it's hard to find it frequently. It's hard to connect various usernames, you know, from this forum and then Reddit and Twitter handles and all that. But I bet GPT-3 could do that.
Yeah. I mean, it wouldn't even necessarily care. I mean, based on how the model builds itself, it doesn't necessarily care about correlating your user behavior across it, but it likely parameterizes it in its information graph somewhere where it's like you as a user probably have similar information or similar ways of speaking that are similar. So you could probably find some graph method to identify or attribute that behavior back to you. But it certainly is not trying to do that as a base case. It's not trying to attribute these particular users speak in a specific way.
But could you do that, I think, is kind of the question. You know, so could you use an AI like this GPT-3 to go out and say, looking at all the user posts in Reddit and these LinkedIn profile or these Facebook's entries or users or whatever, that based on the comments in this, based on this Reddit profile, this looks like this Facebook profile, and say, okay, now these two usernames are equivalent, or, you know, kind of normalizing them across the space and then expanding that out to different forums. And maybe you do that just for those types of social media platforms where you have those conversations going on, where you can figure that out.
Yeah. I mean, you could use GPT-3 as a way to try to figure that out. I think it's one heuristic. If you're trying to map these sorts of similarity scores across users to attribute, I think that it's one of many separate methods. It would not be able to do it on its own, but it would be relatively impactful to say, you know, what do you think this person was, or when do you think this person was born, or where do you think this person lives or comes from based on the language? And if you can generalize about enough of that, you can say, okay, well, based on these different types of characteristics, we have an idea that there's some sort of similarity score from GPT-3. And then maybe we use some open source or closed source and open internet information to identify, you know, more heuristics to be able to try to attribute a particular user's activity.
Because I'm thinking if you took all those data points and you were able to say that all these different pieces of information all relate back to this CTO or this network administrator, and then feed that back into the spear phishing thing to come up with the theme as well as the content of the email and the, you know, how to appeal most or best to this individual to get them to click through, that could be pretty powerful.
Absolutely. And you could connect on the graph to identify who, from an external perspective, who's the best person to create this somewhat organic conversation in the first place.
Right, who to impersonate.
Exactly. So it's incredible spear phishing. Maybe I have five specific candidates that I'm looking to impersonate, and I have the ability to impersonate them well. Well, now all I have to do is compromise that account or spoof it well enough.
And you could even broaden that net a little bit. A little bit more to say that, okay, and what I'm thinking of is like you come up with different types of attributes for your targets and your emails that you generate, right? So you have your buckets we were talking about before for the characteristics for the user. So you take those parameters, then you take the parameters for your emails to say that, okay, it's going to have a link in it. It's going to be themed around college sports. It's going to have an appeal to authority in it, and an appeal to a sense of urgency in the email. And you cross those over and you send those out and you get your results back to see which attributes in the email marry up best with which attributes of the individuals and say, you're going to get greater success if you target network administrators with this personality trait with these types of appeals, and you'll get a click-through rate of 70% or more or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you don't have to spear phish because, you know, it's a numbers game. It's about percentages. You know, you're going to have, 20 or more percent higher on average click-through for any phishing campaign at all. Now if you take that also and you kind of put that into what parameters your defensive techniques are looking for, from your proxies to your email systems, and say, okay, well, we avoid these parameters in the clicking in the link as well, or in the attachment, in order to improve the likelihood that the defense in depth is also going to fail. Because it skirts these different parameters for the defensive capabilities.
Yeah, you could also help build defense better once you've built that sort of component or that series, and see what those click-through rates would be for these particular users. Say you have asset and identity information around these particular users. You could say this is what the attack vectors are for these particular users based on this external information and some sort of, priors. And so this is how we can fit our spear phishing detection to this particular user group of network admins. Maybe you could improve your existing defense in the same type of manner.
Yeah, I think you'd really have to partner with a provider or a large defensive provider like Proofpoint or something that's going to create an anti-spear phishing or anti-AI spear phishing AI.
You know, it has AI twice in the title, so it'll sell better.
Yeah,
I know exactly. I just need to put that on a PowerPoint slide and sell it. Double your AI.
Nice.
You like AI, so we put AI in your AI.
In your eye.
That sounds like fun. I'd love to work on that project. Let me know when you start it, David.
I was actually thinking, I wonder if there, I don't think I get my work to do it, but I think it'd be really cool to do a project trying to produce spearfish from employee PST files. I bet my company wouldn't let me do it though. Because you need feed the emails up to GPT-3 or something. There's no way they let that happen. And I'm not good enough to write my own AI.
And see, this is why I'd like to, you know, get in charge of like a special projects on some large company security team and just say, all right, just think of something cool to do. And here's a programmer, here's a data scientist, and have at it, you know, to build this kind of stuff. It'd be a lot of fun.
Absolutely.
Return on investment.
That's pretty close to what we almost did a couple of years ago with our collaborations, David.
Yeah, almost.
Almost.
All right, so any final thoughts on AI for now? All right, for our second article today, we have a fun one that I thought would generate some interesting discussion. The article is called Hacking the Hire, 3 Ways to Recruit and Retain Cyber Talent. So as everybody knows, this has been repeated over and over and over again to death. There's a cyber talent shortage. It's the end of the world. So the article proposed 3 actions to help close the gap. Action number 1, find internal candidates and train them. Action number 2, find well-referred candidates. Action number 3, this one seems like more than a single action. They kind of crammed a bunch of stuff in here. Establish a good working environment, work-life balance, good benefits, taking time to celebrate achieving goals. So, for our elite panel today, do you guys think there is actually a talent shortage in cybersecurity? And if so, where?
I think there's a talent shortage in qualified talent. I don't think there's a talent shortage overall. I think there are plenty of individuals within cybersecurity. But just based on my overall experience with working with individuals, I'd say that the quality is not where people would like it to be.
I think that's true everywhere. I've worked in retail jobs. I've worked as a teacher. I've worked in restaurants. Like, there's not qualified people everywhere.
Yeah, well, I've only done this and shovel shit. So people that can do that are, you know, pretty easy to find that they're skilled in doing that.
What do you think, Tyler?
I mean, I think that there's what David was mentioning, I think, really speaks to the lack of available talent, right? And there's a smaller pool. So how do you pick the best people consistently? And then there's this, you know, forward push upwards of people that at the biggest organizations retain the best level of talent. And then there's this difficult culture to beat where, you know, this is a cost center of any company. And some companies try to turn, like a threat intelligence center might be turned into a profit center or something like that. But it can be difficult to retain that talent or build it out appropriately because of the finance around it. This is not a revenue generating employee. And I think that's, you know, it generates some symptoms where we have these gaps.
Yeah. I know, speaking for myself, when we were trying to hire analysts for the Security Operations Center, we never had a problem filling the tier one analyst position. We never filled the tier two analyst position, which at that place was more like a tier three. We only had 2 candidates in an entire year that were qualified to even apply.
I've seen very similar. So the question is, where does that talent get sucked up into? Is it Google and Amazon and all the big guys?
Or maybe there's just not enough. Maybe because security wasn't so big 5 or 10 years ago, we're just short on all the senior people. Seems like there are a ton of people coming in for entry level now.
Well, in the article, which I thought was interesting, was according to them anyway, the number of full-time cybersecurity employees only increased 8% in the last 4 years, which sounds really low to me because it seemed, you know, we're always here. Maybe it's just because it's our own perspective that there's this big push to get people into cybersecurity. Maybe, you know, that's the impression that we have because we're on the inside and that's what we're focused on. But in the broader scope of the entire job market, maybe there isn't really very much of a push to get people into cybersecurity if that's all you're getting is 8% in 4 years.
That seems so weird to me because we interviewed so many people for that SOC 1 position. There were a ton of people trying to get into security at the time. Although, again, this is DC. That may have something to do with it.
Are people pivoting out of security into other domains?
I don't know.
I mean, 8% seems like a very low growth rate.
Yeah, especially given all the complaining about it and teams expanding so quickly. Although maybe not mm-hmm. every company is. Maybe we're only getting hired onto those teams.
Yeah, I've seen people transition out of it, but not a large number. But it could be that maybe, you know, you're talking about the number of level ones that you interviewed. It could be that maybe they get discouraged and end up just going into IT, mm-hmm. Straight IT, because they can't yeah. get their foot in the door in cybersecurity, which seems yeah. odd considering everybody talks about shortcomings or shortfalls. But maybe to Tyler's point, the shortfalls aren't at the level one. Maybe yeah. they're at the 2 and 3 yeah. Level.
Especially with what we were paying level ones coming in. That's kind of ridiculous.
Oof. Yeah, if you just stick to it, kid, you'll be doing great in 2 years.
Well, no. We were paying quite a bit.
Oh, really?
In comparison with other jobs like teaching. So starting off as a teacher is like $30,000 a year, unless you're in a city where it's more like 40 or 50. Starting off as a consultant for someone that's not the high end is like 60 to 70,000. Like, we were paying pretty comparable for East Coast rates. Now, if you compare it to, you know, Google, Amazon, Facebook, and the West Coast rates, then that's probably not comparable.
Well, if you remember, several weeks ago, we did that, the economy of the SOC, mm-hmm. Where they were talking about yeah. that the median level one salary is $100,000.
Yeah.
Like crazy high for an entry position.
Again, unless you're working for a bank company on the West Coast, or you're working for like a manager consulting or financial services.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking that's the median across the whole country.
Yeah, that's fair.
So, you know, that probably evens out, because if you're in Des Moines making $100,000, that's pretty good.
Whew. Yeah.
Well, actually not Des Moines anymore, you know, maybe old Des Moines. Because I think the cost of living in Des Moines has actually gone up because of some companies moving there. But
yeah, but if you live 15 minutes outside of Des Moines, it's still.
Yeah,
that's true.
All right. So moving on, though, do you think that the three recommendations address the problem? The internal candidates, the referred candidates, and making sure you have a good working environment?
I mean, they're very general. So I think, yeah. What is benefits? Well, benefits is part of the total compensation package. So, yeah, that's one angle. What is work-life balance? It means different things to different people and different employers. If you're a SOC analyst who's working a shift, then, there's only so many ways you can give balance, right, in some of these different things. But the one that's curious to me is taking time to celebrate achieving goals. What does that mean?
Well, I think I actually think that one is probably understated in most organizations, because one of the things that you talk to a lot of people in cybersecurity about it is how do you tell you're doing good? You know, that you're not Sisyphus every day. So you have to be able to point out why your team is successful versus them saying, well, I'm just pushing this rock up the hill every day and I'm not really seeing any good outcomes for it. I'm not seeing that I'm providing value, that what I do is important. So I think this is really understated at most organizations, that leaders and managers and other employees don't understand that's important to people to feel valued, and that the work they do is important. Because if they're doing the same thing every day and aren't able to tell that they're being successful at it, which is pretty hard to do in security without a good plan, then they're going to feel burnt out and probably want to go to another job just to change things up a little bit.
Yeah, I can't talk for security engineering, but I know security operations and incident response, it really feels like that. You really feel like you're responding to the exact same stuff year in and year out, and nothing ever really gets done.
I remember being a people manager and reading people manager books, and one of the things they constantly talked about was employees need to have a sense of purpose at work, right? And it's so true, having that mission and understanding the work. In cybersecurity, there's a pretty clear mission, but you absolutely do get lost in the sauce a bit in incident response because it's the same, you know, McAfee alerting on itself or whatever that you're seeing over and over and over again. So I think that's absolutely right. Finding unique, tailored ways to make, you know, employees realize their impact is going to be a huge part of culture to keep people going. And then, you know, also these side projects, there's a good number of employees who want to do these side things to create additional value. And so maybe that's how they, you know, benefit the work. They're not improving existing processes, they're coming up with new processes, finding ways to incorporate that effectively, manage it effectively, and then celebrate when they win. I mean, it becomes a very personalized thing. We're talking about celebrating, you know, the value add of the employees. And it's not a one size fit all, but it is a culture thing.
Right. And we talked before about job rotation and giving someone the opportunity to rotate out of a position into another one, at least for a period of time, where they can kind of do their own self-styled stuff, where they can move from monitoring to threat hunting and kind of change that up. And maybe they don't necessarily see their successes so well in the day-to-day monitoring, but if they're able to occasionally move out of that and do something different where they can see that they're moving the needle, that could help as well.
One thing that you noted on here, David, was job descriptions reflecting the actual job and what is required. Do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, the reason that I put that in there is I worked at different organizations where some parts of the job description are kind of dictated by HR, or they kind of try to shoehorn you into a certain job description that's going to apply to all your candidates, even though, let's say you're running a security operations center that actually has a monitoring team and a threat hunt team. HR will sometimes say, well, you have a cybersecurity engineer or cybersecurity analyst level one position. That job description should be the same regardless of whether they're on the monitoring team or the threat hunt team. So even though those positions are doing different roles, because they're both level one analysts, HR would try to force you into saying, okay, you will get one job description for both those roles.
Yeah. And I definitely have seen wacky HR requirements. I had a boss once who wouldn't hire anybody that didn't have a college diploma, but the stuff we were doing was basic IT work. Anybody with a high school, you didn't even need a high school degree to do the work, but he required you to have a college diploma to work there.
Right. And I've seen that for level one security analysts too. They expect them to have bachelor's degrees, even though, you know, it's really not that relevant. Because I don't know how many level one analysts I've hired that cybersecurity isn't actually what they have their bachelor's degree in.
Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, I think biology, I think, was one of the weirdest ones.
I've seen quite a few biologists. That's kind of a funny crossover. And, you know, I got started without a degree and it then was told basically, hey, you need to have a degree. But that as a parameter, especially when it's so hard to, in a lot of cases, hire quality talent, I think you end up filtering a lot of people out. The path to security for a lot of people is atypical.
Yeah. Well, I remember, David, when we worked together, I tried to get our boss to hire a SOC analyst. He was a vet tech and he was switching careers, and he answered all the stuff, answered all their questions great, did well on the technical part of the exam or whatever. And our boss was just like, no, we want technical people. We want FBI people.
Yeah, well, that's because, you know, upper level management has a certain perception as well of what those people look like. And it's kind of important for the hiring level managers to have some level of autonomy from the senior management to be able to make those kinds of decisions. Because if you get your CISO micromanaging who you're hiring as you're at a level one, then you're going to have a hard time.
That's fair. All right. So speaking of technical tests, the author of the article suggested having hands-on technical tests for all technical positions. Is this something you think is a good idea or a bad idea?
I think it's a good idea if you structure them right. I've seen different kinds of tests where they just show packet captures or whatever, but if you can actually, here's where if you have a tech simulation tool, could be hugely beneficial. Because you could run a simulation and then have them look at that simulation and say, okay, what happened here? Actually in, you know, maybe not necessarily your production tools, but you can have them look in the, at a tool set that they're going to be using and be able to tell what their level of understanding is.
Yeah. No, I've definitely found that to be a really good way of separating out actual technical people versus people that just have some academic background but can't actually identify a SQL injection, for example. And depending on how it's set up, you can also get a great idea of how people think and see where maybe they don't know the word SQL injection, but maybe they can look at and be like, huh, you know, they're looking for an admin user. That seems like that's kind of important. And I don't think that should be in this URL.
Right. Because if they have the understanding, but not the terminology, mm-hmm. that's just as good. The terminology can be learned. It's the, the analytical mindset and thought processes are harder to develop if they don't already exist.
Yeah. So here's a question that he mentioned that I thought was kind of weird. Everybody always talks about how people leave bosses. I don't know that I agree with that, but how do you guys feel about that statement?
I think that there's a lot of stressors and potential triggers that cause an employee to seek gainful employment in other places, right? And it may be the boss. I think that the person who's writing a book on people leave bosses is designing something to make it so that managers read their book. But, you know, I think that's it's a valuable part of it. You know, the manager in a lot of cases sets the culture, you know, depending on what level they're at. It's not always the direct manager. Sometimes it's higher up in the hierarchy that the culture is set. You know, they say fish rots from the head or whatever. But that sort of culture is instantiated by the layers of management and also to some degree the employees, you know, that are the persons working alongside. But I don't think that is the only parameter. Obviously, there's also, you know, salary component. What mission am I working on? Are there other teams of individuals elsewhere that maybe would be cool to work with, or other problem sets, or different industry verticals that are more, you know, exciting? I think there's a lot of different, you know, reasons. It's mm-hmm. not just the manager you work for and report to and get a yearly raise, hopefully, from.
Yeah, like Tyler said, I think it's really more the organizational culture of the team and the broader team that you're working under that really determines that, not necessarily the boss so much. And going back to the talking about the celebrating successes thing is, you know, if they feel like they're not valuable or not valued, then that is something else that's going to play into their decision to look for something else.
Yeah. And what about growing your career? A lot of times it's difficult to move up when you're working for a company where there's only one or two management positions and you have to wait for somebody to leave. The team isn't growing. They're not creating new positions.
Well, I think some of that depends on if you actually want to be in management.
Well, it's not just management. That also goes for, you know, if you want to do threat intel and you're working at a mid-sized company and there's no threat intel, there's you can take that any number of ways.
Well, I think we may have talked about this before where they talked to the founders of LinkedIn about, you have to have a culture where you accept people leaving so that they can come back later with new skills. Mm. So if there's not an opportunity for them to move up, I think, you know, they should be honest with their management, and their management should be honest with them about that possibility and say, hey, what you want, you're not going to find here, but you go out and you get that, you come back and bring that back to the organization. Because whenever you hire an employee, you're also expecting some kind of return on investment on that employee. So you're hiring them to do work and provide value to the organization. But how long do they need to provide that value before you'd say, okay, well, the amount of expense we put into hiring that individual, we've received that back. Because I don't think hiring an employee, expecting them to work for that company for 20 years is realistic anymore. But if you get value out of them and they go somewhere else and you've maintained that relationship with the employee that they still value or respect your company, then they may go out, get other skills and qualifications and come back better back to the organization in the future where where you can kind of build on what you've already done with that employee during the first hire.
And what about everybody's favorite, cold hard cash? At what point are you disadvantaging yourself by not leaving for a job that pays substantially more?
Well, there's a lot of different parameters that go into deciding where you're going to work, whether, you know, you're going to continue to work in the same place or work elsewhere in security or really any of these faster paced vector, like where there's just a lot of movement potential to different organizations, you know, compensation in the team and some of those elements we've been talking about, the actual mission itself, the learning ability, all of them play a part into the overall, you know, compensation package. But cold hard cash is obviously huge. Those are lifestyle bucks that allow you to spend your time outside of your 40 hours, right? So I don't know. It's certainly not the only thing. I think there's a lower threshold for certain years of experience that's acceptable. And especially given some, you know, level of specialization, like if you're one of the best threat intel researchers in the world, there's only certain organizations that are going to be able to compensate you fairly for the value that you add. So sometimes you know, as David was alluding to, you might have to leave to be able to find that sort of place because the organization is not where that happens.
There was a linked survey in the article to a survey called The Life and Times of Cybersecurity Professionals, which was produced by ESG and ISSA. And it lists four things to do to close the skills gap. These were the four highest rated and voted items from the survey. Number one, commitment to more training. Number two, improved compensation package. Number three, improved benefits such as paying for certs and participation for industry events. Number four, creation and improvement of a cybersecurity internship program. I thought all those were kind of interesting, but one of the things that I would be most interested in getting in a future job would be more paid time off. And a lot of places talk about the work-life balance, but a lot of places seem really hesitant to give additional time off and are more happy to throw money. I don't know, have you guys run into that?
I think there's a perception that having people in seats for more hours a week produces better outcomes that isn't necessarily always accurate. But you know, if you're, what you're basically saying is 40 hours a week, I would prefer to work less hours a week. And I'd take a cut in compensation in exchange for that. I think is it's hard because there's so much legislation around, you know, who is what level of employee based on number of hours contributed per week. So because there's these guidelines around a minimum of 32 and a maximum of 40 or something like that, maybe it's a little bit more difficult to manage. But I haven't run into anybody personally other than you who's thought that. I think everyone would like to work a little bit less, but sacrificing pay in exchange for it, you're the only person I've seen that's been a huge proponent of that. I don't know, David, have you seen anything else?
Well, actually, I had what I thought was the ideal schedule at one time, which was 4-10s. So I had a three-day weekend every weekend for several years. And I tell you, that was absolutely the best schedule or the best work scenario that I've ever had. It was awesome having every weekend was a three-day weekend. And to return to that would be fantastic. And actually, you know, I've talked to other folks who think that that's also a good idea. Because I think one of the things that you alluded to that no one really even talks about is that possibility of more time off as a benefit. You know, people in HR or managers or whatever, they don't see that as an option. So it's not brought up as an option in companies because of, you know, stuff that Tyler mentioned a minute ago about regulations, full-time, part-time, overtime, and all that, shy away from that possible option as a benefit. But I can tell you, just talking with other employees about it, they would be really interested in that option, even if it were 4-10s versus a 32-hour week, just to get a three-day weekend.
I mean, if you consider the amount of time that I have to travel into DC to go to work, I'm basically doing 10 hours a day anyways or more.
Yeah, well, that's one of the benefits of having the full-time remote is not having that commute time, because that was, you know, at least for me, it was, you know, between 10 and 20 hours, depending on what was going on with traffic and everything, per week, just in commute, where you get some of that time back.
What do you think about these roles at the bigger tech companies that are offering unlimited PTO, right? And I know sometimes they're wrought with bad culture around that, but if it's true unlimited PTO, which can be hard to manage in an outcomes-based organization where, you know, you're billing a customer based on your hours worked or whatever, like pro services. But
the whole thing's a scam.
Yeah, go ahead.
Is it?
I mean, companies aren't doing this because, you know, they adds a benefit or something that's going to, as I think we've talked about before, HR is there for the company. They're not there for people. It's the same thing with PTO. PTO, they don't offer you PTO before you. They offer it for themselves because people are expecting that time off as a benefit. Now, if you give them unlimited PTO, quote unquote, because we're Americans, we don't take all of our PTO anyway. So they know that no one's going to be banking any PTO. So they don't have to be recompensated for that at turnover at the end of the year or when the employee leaves. So really what they're doing is they're shortening the amount of vacation you actually get because no one takes it anyway. So over the entire company, you may have certain individuals that will take 4 or 5 weeks if they're even allowed to, because management always says is going to have a say on that. But the number of people that take 4 and 5 weeks is going to be a small fraction versus the number of people that take 2 or less weeks a year when, you know, the average vacation for the overall company, if you were giving them straight PTO, would be 3 weeks or 4 weeks. So it's just a way for them to get more money.
Yeah. I think some, and I understand from the accounting principles what you're talking about. Like if I don't have to forecast these 23 days that an employee takes a year, and when they get terminated, I don't have to pay it out. There's certainly some benefit that a CFO somewhere is very happy about, right, across 100,000 employees. But I've heard multiple times from large tech companies specifically saying, oh, well, everyone take a day off, or being really focused around everyone taking like a week or two during this 3 month period of time, just because, you know, they know from an organizational standpoint that people aren't so good at taking it, and they actually do want to drive productivity or culture in a way. But it's really only these $1 trillion organizations, I think, that are making those sorts of decisions, where it's not just, hey, CFO is looking at this program in this particular way as an outcome to return to shareholder value, but rather as we need to retain the best employees. We've already hired the best employees. Let's talk about actual human benefits. But the organizations that can provide that are these $1 trillion, you know, plus organizations in a lot of cases.
Yeah. I think it depends strongly on how they actually handle that. I don't think unlimited PTO is reasonable at all, unless you're some kind of wunderkind who can, you know, do all of your annual stuff in 2 months and then take 10 months off, but then they'll just fire you. But I think if it done well, you could probably get 5 or 6 weeks and get more than your standard, you know, 2 or 3 weeks or whatever you're getting wherever you are.
Yeah, I think, you know, it probably would work out really well for organizations that can really be outcome based.
Yeah.
Because if you're working on tasks and assignments in like an agile kind of scenario where, you know, Matt, you need to get this done in order to feed into this process. If it takes 2 hours to get done, you know, take the other 6 hours off because, you know, you've met your objective.
Yeah.
I think if work overall could move in that direction, people overall would be much happier.
That makes sense. All right. So why does this matter? This matters because hiring people is literally the most important part of your job if you're a manager. And what can you or should you do about it? You should take the time, hire the best people you can, hire for personality and aptitude. You can always train skills. And you should focus on trying to make that best environment to keep them there. As has come across here, it's different for every person. At my point in my career, I'm looking to value extra time off. It may be extra compensation. It may be having that recognition that Tyler was talking about and the management skills that your boss shows. So I feel like that's a pretty big part of it there, is trying to figure out what exactly is motivating all of your employees and how you can meet those needs.
And hopefully you can work with your HR in order to customize that for your employees as well. Because maybe one employee works better in this type of benefit scenario, and this one works better in this one, where instead of having a one size fits all. But that's much more easy to say than to do. Well, it looks like that's all the articles we have for today. Thank you for joining us, and follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter, and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.